I'm joined today by Rahul Talang, who is Professor of Information Systems at the Heinz College and the Tepper School of Business at Carnegie Mellon. Rahul's work focuses on how the digitization of information impacts consumers, businesses, and policies. And he has done significant research understanding and shaping an optimal copyright and intellectual property policy in the digitization era. Rahul is the author of Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data, and the Future of Entertainment. Rahul, thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of Tech Hype. One of the main goals of Tech Hype is to debunk misunderstandings around emerging tech so we can fully understand the real benefits and risks. What do you think are the three most common misunderstandings about how AI, or digitization more broadly, is actually transforming the entertainment landscape?
Thank you, Brandy. Thank you for having me. I think, you know, given the strike happening, you know, there's a big kind of discussion about the whole how the AI is going to have an impact. I feel like there are three major misunderstandings. I think number one, there's a feeling that the writers and the actors want to ban AI in the entertainment space. I don't think they want that. I do not think that's what they want. I think they realize that AI is here to stay. They also realize that the studios are going to use AI. Somebody else are going to use the AI. They also realize that some of the AI actually can benefit them. So they don't want the AI to be banned. They just want to make sure their interests are protected. As the studios start using more and more AI, they want to make sure that the actors and writers' interests are basically protected. So that's one major misunderstanding that we hear about.
Great. And I have a quick follow-up question on that for this first misunderstanding. I can imagine there's also probably a misunderstanding about the role of AI in the entertainment industry. So if these actors and writers are saying, okay, let's not throw it out, but let's actually figure out ways we can harness it in a way that benefits us, what are some of the ways AI is actually being used?
So again, you know, this is a very fast moving space. So right now, if you hear some interviews, they think that, you know, scripts are being written by the AI and the writers are hired to add on to the AI. So essentially, they're saying that they're actually replacing us. They are worried that the actors are worried that, hey, my voice is basically being used and now I don't need to be there. They are actually worried that their past information, either the past script or the past information, that is going to be processed in the regenerative AI and something will come out of it, which will be used without they getting improper credit. So, you know, I don't think that's happening in the large scale. Maybe in some small cases, some small firms might be doing that. But you can imagine, you know, the threat, or they feel like, hey, if they don't do something, this actually will happen and that will have a major impact on their livelihood. So I think, you know, that fear or the lack of information or misunderstanding is kind of widespread, that if you ask somebody what is going to be the AI going to do, you know, there's a broad brush saying that, hey, it's going to replace the writers and the actors and so on and so forth. So I think that seems to be like a common misunderstanding.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I think that's a really important issue to be addressing, not just that these actors see the technology coming in, but how might they harness it in a way that benefits them and be able to give them the credit where credit is due. What are some other misunderstandings you want our audience to know?
The second misunderstanding is, I think, again, that is the AI will start infringing on the copyright, which actually goes back to the discussion I had. The worry is that, you know, the large regenerative model will basically come in, write the script, they will use all the past data, write the script, and basically infringe on the scripts or the writing written in the past by the writers.
And there's some big lawsuits on this right now, right? Sarah Silverman is suing OpenAI. We have the Anderson case against Midjourney, DeviantArt, and Stable Diffusion. How do you think those cases are going to end up? Do you think the copyright will be considered infringed upon or not?
I mean, actually, this is a question which is beyond the music industry or beyond the entertainment industry. This whole notion that I can use the past data to make the prediction without actually giving proper copyright credit to the people who have created the text or the knowledge, you know, that's a bigger question, you know. And I feel that I think there's a broad understanding. And if you look at some of the bills that have come about in either in the EU or in the US, there's an explicit mandate that if the models are going to be trained or some knowledge in the past, that knowledge has to be recognized. It has to be explicitly noted that that particular piece of knowledge was basically used to train the model. And the moment you do that, then obviously all the copyright, the money, that kind of falls in basically place. I don't know. I don't think they have an agreement about how the money will be exchanged. But my feeling is that this whole issue of protecting copyright is not limited to entertainment alone. I mean, that's a much broader issue. And I think governments are actually pretty seriously thinking about it. I think a lot of firms also realize that, hey, they cannot just use the knowledge by somebody else in some other context and basically reuse it, repackage it, and like harness something out of it. So I don't think that's going to happen. The exact form of how the whole thing will be protected is, you know, not very clear. But I think everybody understands that we have to protect the intellectual property. And I think that is going to absolutely happen.
Yeah, and I think there's a very important point to bring up, and you touched on this, but the role of legislation in this space. So the EU AI Act, I believe currently in the current version, has a portion around documenting what data was used to train a generative AI model. So step one, documenting, making sure that if you are using any copyrighted material, that that's clearly documented. Any other misunderstandings you'd like to touch on for our guests?
This may not be a misunderstanding, but I think I feel like controlling the AI in the US entertainment industry itself is not enough. And the reason for that is the US entertainment industry is so intertwined. You know, we already have connection with, you know, stuff going on in Japan or India or Mexico or Europe. If you control things in the US and the content is basically going to and fro, let's just say from Japan or India, and they don't have a proper mandate like we have, I think it really become difficult. How do you put the you know, safeguard? So for example, I think we all familiar, you know, Squid Game, which was basically a Korean show, became like hugely popular.
And yeah, it's like pop culture experience in the US, definitely, for sure.
And if you look at the streaming networks, they have a large footprint. I mean, many of them have a bigger share actually outside US. So whether it's Disney, whether it's Netflix, whether it's HBO Max, they all want to penetrate. And when they're penetrating, they're creating show in the local culture, local language. Naturally, their desire is to have some sort of a cross-pollination. That's how can they have a show which is produced, let's just say, in England, make it more popular here, or Canada, or Japan, or India, or whatever you want to call it. So a lot of this stuff is already happening. So when you try to control things only in this country, you know, you don't know what is going to happen in other countries. Maybe they're actually much more open about how Netflix can use the content and the actors and the voice and the AI. They might actually have an incentive to create content there. And they say, I'm going to position the content to my US audience or to my Mexican audience. So all I'm saying is this issue is actually more complicated, you know, because this is not like a local retail issue. It has become more international, given the entertainment industry has also become very highly diversified. So I think this is a much deeper question than what we think.
Yeah. And in every episode, we actually try to break down what are some of the real benefits and risks. And the example that you just gave, I can see some real benefits to that, being able to share content and translate it to different audiences, but also some risks of not spurring local content creation, but instead using it from one country and just repackaging it for another. Can you talk a little bit about some more of the benefits and risks you see of the digitization of the entertainment industry?
I mean, the benefits is this enormous benefit that it has led to. Basically, the reach of the content has become significant. Beyond the digitization of content, the people are able to access content no matter what socioeconomic characteristic they have. You know, 30 years ago, the only way you can consume a movie if you went to theater or you had a CD or you had a VCR. Nowadays, if you have a mobile phone, you can basically watch most of the content, most of the entertainment. And the mobile phone has become all pervasive. You know, in a poor country, poor people, they also have a mobile phone. They can look at the YouTube as easily as you and I can look at. So the reach of the content of the entertainment has become so widespread that automatically also means that the content has to become diverse, because the people who are watching are also extremely diverse. So what I'm saying is that the amount of content that is in demand and the amount of content that is being produced is actually much more than what it was 10 years, 20 years ago. The content also has the international reach. So when the content is produced in Korea or Japan or India, they know they can actually reach to a people which is beyond their own country. I mean, just look at the US. You know, the US movies actually make more money outside US than in the US.
Yeah, so, than they do domestically, yes.
I mean, if you look at, you know, a lot of time, the domestic market, you know, it's okay if it's doing well. You know, sometimes the movies might not do all that well in domestic market, but they do enormously well in the international market. So this is cross-pollination has a huge benefit to the actors, to the producers, to the writers, because now they have a much wider scale, much wider demand, much wider scope than limited to their own niche geography that used to happen earlier.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that, because the strike, there's also serious concerns about moving to streaming services and making sure that the writers and actors, producers are actually deriving the correct or accurate financial benefit from that. And so you're talking about how streaming has really opened up the distribution of content globally, which is great, but how is it also, you know, what are some of those risks and how is it harming potentially the entertainment industry?
So, I mean, you asked like a much bigger question, which actually is a question about the whole compensation that goes to the actors and the directors and the writers based on the show they produce. In the earlier days, and when I say earlier, I meant only like 2-3 years ago, when the content used to be produced.
Yeah, these days are fast. Now, last week feels like, you know, everything's happening all at once in this generative AI space. But yeah, okay, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so when the content used to be produced for, let's just say, a television network, you know, so you write a show, you produce a movie or whatever, you get compensation for what actually is the demand for that country, for that network, for whatever time you have the contract for. Mm-hmm. Then the contract actually gets sold or to some other country, some other network in XYZ. The contract is very clear. If that happens, the money has to come back to the writers and the directors. Okay. And if there's a rerun, the whole thing at some level was actually a function of people had a pretty good idea about the demand. So if the contract got actually, or your show got licensed to other network, you had a pretty good idea how much demand it will generate, or you actually knew how much demand it was generating. And that led to the what they call the residual. you know, the moment you move into the streaming network, I mean, that thing become very, very unknown. You know, in Netflix, I don't know precisely how the contracts are. So Netflix might produce a show, let's just say in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And the show actually is played out in Mexico or in Peru or in mm-hmm. US. I'm sure they have something written in the contract, but let's just say the show was written in Spain. It got hugely popular in Mexico. I do not think that the actors or the directors or the writers actually get the fair compensation, because it was never perceived, it was never thought about, and frankly, how popular that show is in Mexico, even that number is not known to anybody. Maybe Netflix knows that number, but they don't share the number. Nobody knows that. It kind of becomes opaque, and that automatically, you can imagine, that creates all kind of uncertainty. What I say is that how the money flows kind of become like a black box, and that creates the issue about how fair their compensation is. I mean, you can ask the producer and they say, we are being fair. If they ask the actor, they say, hey, they're not being fair. So, you know, one of those things that you can never agree on something because you don't know what the numbers are.
Exactly. And I can actually see in the future that combining this, you know, streaming with, you know, maybe even collaboration with generative AI tools, determining how much goes to each individual, like whose contribution and how much, will just become more and more difficult to calculate.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, beyond generative AI, I mean, this whole issue is actually a pretty tricky issue because the widespread belief is that the streaming companies don't want to share the numbers. And the streaming companies have reasons to believe that just because you're watching 10 hours of streaming every month doesn't mean that the friends or the office should actually get appropriate revenue, because you don't know. Sometimes you might be watching the show, you might be putting the show, you're not watching it, you might be watching it again and again. So it's very hard to put the numbers. So they are reluctant to share the number. The numbers are all unknown. And what the actors or the writers say that, hey, you know, this company's CEO, this company's top executives are getting paid so much, I'm not getting my money. So they basically say, hey, you're getting paid so much, I'm not getting money, that's very unfair, I need my money. But the, you know, again, the metric of how the money has to be paid is sort of unknown. And I think that has been like a, one of the major reasons that we have the strike. I mean, frankly, yeah. AI is obviously a big reason, but the AI is also the money that is being generated or replaced also has kind of become very opaque and all creating like a perfect storm.
Yeah, and I can also, I mean, there's another part of AI we haven't even discussed yet, and that's the recommender systems used by these platforms to actually recommend content. And I heard yesterday, I was discussing with a colleague who mentioned, did you notice that when you go onto Netflix and you see a show or movie displayed for you, that they will choose a still from that movie that they think you're more likely to click on? So it's also thinking about the role of Netflix in prioritizing content and what their decision making is there. And I think we need to be a little bit skeptical, because they're not only the distribution network, they also produce the content. So they have incentive to push their own content over another entity's content.
Actually, one of the risks of what's happening in the digitized world, before all these big platforms came in, mm-hmm. you know, it used to be dominated by the major studios and the major labels. So if you're a producer or a writer, if you want to get well known or at least get attention from the audience, you have to work with the studio or yep. you have to work with the label. So they sort of became your gatekeeper. Then what happened is that all these players saw the platform came in, they gave opportunities for people to go in and do whatever they want. So YouTube became like a go-to place. You know, you can produce movie, you can produce music, you don't need a major label, you don't need like a, you know, major studio, you can produce your own content, you can, you know, you can put together your own music, and YouTube will allow you to put it out there for people to consume. Same with the Spotify. You know, you can put your music on Spotify, and Spotify will say, you know, give me whatever 20%, 30%, and I'll let anybody stream it. So they kind of made the whole thing democratic. That just means that so many, you know, artists can actually go and start, you know, producing the content. But the moment that happened, they also sort of became gatekeeper. So as you said, your colleague mentioned that they are the ones who are recommending, you know, because there's so much content on Netflix. There's so many songs on, you know, Spotify. A user would not know which song they should listen to.
Exactly.
Whatever Spotify recommends you, that's what you end up listening. Now, Spotify sometimes is also producing music. You know, Netflix itself is also producing show, obviously. So yeah. They have incentive to basically use their platform to promote their own stuff. You know, this is not limited to Netflix or, you know, Spotify. Look at what's happening with the YouTube. You know, there's a lot of accusation that YouTube is using their power for their own promotion. Or Amazon, you know, Amazon used to be a bookseller. Mm-hmm. Now they've become a, you know, third party seller and they're doing their own thing, you know, right or wrong, because they're powerful, they can do things. People are skeptical that, hey, they're doing something not very good for the audience or for the general social good of people. So, you know, you had power earlier, which you didn't like it. Now the power has gone to, you know, other tribe. You don't like that either. So, you know, there's never like a win-win. You know, there's always, you know, you're swinging from one place to the other. But yeah, so that's definitely one of the risks.
And I'm really happy that you brought up YouTube, because we don't often think about YouTube, I mean, as like an entertainment industry stakeholder, but it really is. They're also not immune to this issue of the recommendation of content, right? YouTube has an incentive to recommend content that people will likely continue to watch. And we know that YouTube has a whole funding mechanism where they, you know, pay and they monetize channels of certain very popular YouTube channels. And so, yeah, we see this again. I think one of the key points I'm hearing from you is a bit, you know, we need more of that transparency in what's actually happening. But obviously that is difficult when these companies won't necessarily want to give up that information because it might be proprietary.
Absolutely. I mean, imagine if Disney has to share the information about how much people are consuming their on their Disney platform. The stock market might react in a different way. You know, the stock prices actually might go down. You know, people will say, you know what? The stock of Disney was selling for so much because we thought Disney Plus is doing so well or Netflix is doing so well. I see the number. They look very lukewarm. They don't look that. So what I'm saying is that sometimes the reactions are not rational. You know, the investor might actually say that, you know, they're not doing well and they might punish them heavily. That just means that whatever future plan they have, they can be busted. So they are also very reluctant to share the number because they don't know how you would react. So, you know, it's all very, you know, it's all very complicated.
Yeah, and we saw that, right, with Netflix, where some of the content that they had produced and spent a lot of money on wasn't performing as well as they had intended. And I remember when that happened, there was this, you know, kind of fear about, is Netflix going to be able to survive its, you know, huge spending?
I mean, you may or may not know, if you look at like last 2 years, all the streaming platform, they were creating so much content because one of the major goal of most of the streaming platform, HBO Max, Disney, Hulu, Paramount, their goal was to basically say, I got so many customers. So they just wanted to say that this quarter I signed up so many people, this quarter I signed up so many people. And one of the ways they thought they could do that by producing more and more content. So more catchy content they produce, more people will sign up. And that kind of became their metric, that how many people are actually signing up. And stock market was rewarding them. So they thought, yeah, that's a good idea. So they produce so much content eventually everybody realized that, you know what, producing too much content is not the way to go forward. So they said, okay, I'm going to cut down the content. I don't want so much content. They started canceling shows. They started basically not recruiting so many writers, actors, so on and so forth. And then everybody said that, you know what, they're in big trouble. So, you know, it's almost like that. You know, when the economic leaves the thinking, when you're driven by how many customers are signing up rather than, you know, how much of the content you're producing, is it actually worth it? Is it worth for the customer who is signing up? You know, when that goes out of the window, this creates this kind of situation where, you know, we kind of in an uncertain world, you know, we haven't reached the right equilibrium. We don't know exactly how to evaluate a streaming company. And that is creating all the issue that we see.
Exactly. And also in the tech hype episode, we want to talk about what are some of those concrete technical and policy strategies that we can implement to address some of these risks you've raised, but also the benefits.
I mean, one of the things that I think all of us are hearing, and that is not limited to entertainment, but the entertainment is the big reason. How can the AI be used in a fair way? And when I say unfair way, so for example, the AI can be used to, you know, copy somebody's voice. AI can be used to create shows or create content without giving credit to the people who have created it. You know, have your voice, have your music. So there can be all kind of use of AI, which may or may not be fair. So there's a lot of focus that how the AI can be used responsibly. You know, typically we know that AI has been used. You might have heard about hiring. So let's just say I want to hire people. I don't want to have the people hiring. I want to have AI decide who to hire. So AI is going to look at the, you know, resume. AI is going to hire the people. There's a lot of concern that, you know, AI is creating its own bias, you know. It's, you know, either not hiring, you know, minority, not hiring enough, you know, women, and all kind of thing. Because AI is, at some level, is sort of black box, you know, what is doing is sort of unknown even for the firm which is actually implementing AI. So the fair use of AI is a bigger question. It becomes right. Much more relevant for the entertainment that how the AI can be used in a fair way.
So it's definitely an important issue in the entertainment industry, especially for using generative AI systems that might definitely replicate past biases. Could you give me one more strategy and then we're going to close it out?
I mean, in the same vein, you know, if you think about the AI being, you know, copyright, I think, I already mentioned that.
How do you protect
the copyrights even when you're using AI? So, for example, how do I make sure that I give the credit to the writer whose content I'm using to train? How do I compensate? If you actually step back, you know, a lot of writers, you know, they get compensation, but they also want recognition because they actually get money. They actually generate value when their content is, they recognize somebody created content that became successful, came on CBS, NBC, ABC, or the movie. So while they are getting money from the movie, which may or may not be enough for them, they get the brand name that they actually monetize going forward. So that is really critical for them. That is, they want, if their name is being used, their content is being used, they want the recognition. That is, this person actually created the content that generated so much money. And I think that is really the missing piece. The moment generative AI comes in, that brand name, that recognition, the name that was associated with somebody, that becomes like a messy point. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I can actually see this getting more and more difficult as generative AI partners with human writers. So, Rahul, thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of Tech Hype, where we've really uncovered all of these benefits and risks and the digitization of the entertainment industry. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Randy.
Of course. Tech Hype was brought to you by the Citrus Policy Lab in the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Want to better differentiate fact from fiction about other emerging technologies? Check out our other Tech Hype episodes at techhype.org.